on the weekend panel this morning. We've got them now, our panellists. Ali Jones, sometime broadcaster and city councillor from Red PR in Christchurch. Kia ora, Ali.
Kia ora. How are you, Jim?
Very well, thank you. And with her, the former Dean of Law at Canterbury University, now adjunct professor at Massey, but also chief executive of the Sisters of Compassion Group, overseeing its work among the elderly and marginalised communities, Dr. Chris Scallivan. Morena.
Morena, Jim. Morena. Great to have spoken to you for ages.
It's been a long time. You sound currently as if you're in a tunnel, but we'll see if that improves as we go along. A highlight or low moment from the week from each of you, please. Ali, can you do the honours first?
I'm going to start off. This is pretty light, I suppose, but, you know, that's what a good thing is these days. Went to see Little Shop of Horrors at the Court Theatre on Friday night. Now, that's where I started my working life, straight out of high school as a stage manager at the Court some number of years ago. And one of the first shows I did there 35 years ago was Little Shop of Horrors. So it was really interesting to go back and see the same show done in a different time, obviously with different performers as well. I remember Peter Elliott played Oren the Dentist in the version we did. Hadlow was in ours. Yeah, I mean, we are talking a long time ago, but man, they did an awesome job. And I still know every word of all the songs. I used to listen to the soundtrack, but I watched the audience around and they were a little quieter than normal. I know Christchurch audiences are not known for being overly, excitable. Some of them don't even take their coats off when they sit down in the seats in the theatre, I remember said some years ago. But they warmed up and by the end of it were really into it. And with all the news that's going on at the moment, it was a really lovely environment to be in. So that's certainly the high point for me this week.
What's the most famous song from Little Shop of... forgive me, I've forgotten.
Probably the main one, Little Shop of Horrors, which is the main one. And then there's Feed Me Seymour, Feed Me Now, which is the plant. So, yeah, I don't think it's not like the big sort of, you know, the ones that are on Broadway and so forth for fame as far as the songs go. All of them are good, Jim, all of them.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not like West Side Story.
I hear a line.
Sorry, Chris, we were trying to say something.
No, there should be. I didn't even have a wine, Chris, because I knew if I had one or two wines, I'd actually start singing all the bloody songs.
Now, Chris, what is happening with your...
I can hear you. It's too early for a wine.
Can you hear me, Chris, because your line's still a bit ropey?
I can hear you. Lovely. Loud and clear at my end.
Excellent. So what has caught your attention this past week?
It's again fairly light, but again, as Ali said, that's the essence of things that have been the highlight. It's the people's reaction when you say you're going to be speaking to Jim Moira in the weekend. I've got a very good friend, Julie Roberts, and I just mentioned it in passing. And the mere thought of being one degree of separation from John James Schnell Moira sends many people sort of doughy-eyed, weak-kneed, and into a babbling mess. You're more of an icon in New Zealand than you perhaps know, Jim. So that was a real highlight for me.
It's a bit spooky how you name the full name, but thanks very much. All right, let's get on to the National Party leadership vacuum. And we'll speak later in the morning to political commentator Richard Harman, who thinks we may have a result, or not a result, but it may be decided earlier than Tuesday. I think we all know the background behind the departure of Judith Collins. Chris, you first, your impressions of what's gone on, please.
Yeah, Jim, this is my low light, actually, for the week as well. And it's simply that it seems utterly and completely unnecessary. And, I often say I'm not Māori, but have, I think, more to learn from Māori than what they have to learn from me. And what I'm really taken by is the notion of mana-enhancing conversations. And that certainly wasn't on all fronts what happened this week. It's hard to know, you know, the speculation that she might have torpedoed herself and that she might not have necessarily wanted to continue on as leader. Others that, you know, that it was a meltdown at night and a quick snap judgment that was clearly the wrong one. And others that, you know, this is part of the course of her modus operandi, of the way she sort of does business and her leadership style. Whatever it was, nobody comes out of this looking good. And I think the public of New Zealand are much poorer for having now a weaker opposition.
Mm. Vis-a-vis what Chris has just said, I mean, Judith Collins said she was relieved to go, happy to be an MP again. So do you think she saw the writing in such large font on the wall that she kind of thought a version of I'm off?
Yeah, look, I do. Although when you look at things like the decision to sit down in the church and pray and that lovely picture that keeps being thrown up in the stories we're seeing at the moment on the telly about Judith Collins' leadership time, I mean, that was a pretty poor decision as well. But I do, I get a real sense that this was her swan song, essentially. And I think she probably wanted to inflict as much damage on Bridges as she could before she went. And I think she's probably done that. I think what's really frightening is that the just doesn't seem to have been any planning in the National Party for this occurrence, which was definitely going to happen. There's no succession plan here at all. And here we are now with choices of Bridges, Mitchell and Luxon. All three just give me the screaming heebie-jeebies. And I've heard people say things like bring back Amy Adams and what a shame we don't have Paula Bennett there. And I can see that as well. It's frightening that we don't have an opposition in this country to hold the government to account and challenge the government intelligently and strongly, which is what we need.
Jacinda Ardern, in her time as Labour leader, has now had five national leaders opposite her, if you count Shane Retty. And if you had to put money on the sixth one, Ali, you first this time, who would it be?
I've been thinking about that a lot in the last sort of 24, 48 hours. Oh, God, I think it's going to be Bridges. But I think that's because he's already got a reasonable recognition there amongst Kiwis, and I think that's what's important. We do know whether it's good or bad. We know about him. Luxon's got the issue, I think, of the fundamentalist Christian issue, which is just – and he's very new. I think that's going to be problematic. Mitchell, look, probably a lovely chap, and I don't want to sound awful, but he strikes me as the sort of person that struggles to tie his shoelaces. And Bridges, at least – we've got some knowledge of, although he brings baggage with him as well. God, well, it's Hobson's choice, really, isn't it?
No, we don't want to sound too awful, do we? Because you've both hinted that New Zealand needs, you know, a coherent, cohesive opposition party. Chris, who do you think would be in charge of it by Tuesday?
I'm with Ali. I've been sort of tying myself up for the last 48 hours thinking about it. In fact, probably not much else. And just as Ali did a good expose of the strengths and flaws, for the strengths for what they are, with the significant flaws that each of them have. For my money, I can't understand why Christopher Luxon would ever want to put his name forward, to be honest. If I were him, I'd keep my powder dry. Fairly certain in the knowledge that they're likely to lose the next election, unless there really is something very dramatic that happens between now and then. And that I'm only been in there, you know, a little over a year or so. And that if I keep my powder dry, then clearly he is the person who's being groomed and set up to be the Prime Minister of the future. And so I don't know what on earth would be in his favour for him to put his hand up now. I think if I were him, I'd be happy to give it over to Simon. And I think it is probably Simon. I'm with Ali. As far as Mark Mitchell is concerned, don't want to disparage the guy, but who?
I'm just trying to get my microphone to work again, which it has obliged, thankfully. Speaking of things that happen between now and then, actually, as we'll probably talk about with Richard later on as well, as Harold Wilson most famously said, events. And getting on to COVID and its associated issues with the new Omicron variant, are you both grateful we still have a hard border in place, actually, such a hard border? Ali?
I think you'd have to be, wouldn't you? I mean, the fact that we've, I see in the news this morning, already re-implemented some bans, particularly with those African countries, would suggest that having a hard border is a very, very good idea. Look, I don't know much about it. It seems to be changing very, very quickly. And so I don't know. But yes, to answer your question, yes, very pleased we've still got a hard border.
All right. The point's been made that this internal hemorrhaging of the National Party happened in a week of fierce debate over the human rights implications of the COVID-19 response vaccinations legislation bill, allowing businesses to fire employees if they don't get vaccinated, i.e. politicians have bigger fish to fry than, you know, dramatically relitigating five-year-old crudities. Amnesty International has serious concerns about any rushed legislation limiting human rights. Chris, do you?
Oh, look, I do, but probably for a different reason than many New Zealanders. Al Gillespie and Claire Breen, you know Al well, you have him on the show a lot, both professors at Waikato University, wrote a great piece together a couple of weeks ago on some of the intricacies. And we get quite technical quite quickly, but no really right under the New Zealand Bill of Rights is absolute. There's a Section 5 in there that says that these rights are able to be limited, are demonstrably justifiable in a free and democratic society. Section 7 says the Attorney General needs to do an assessment of any legislation that comes before Parliament to see whether it's consistent or not. My worry is that assessment should really just be a one-liner saying it looks like it's consistent or it looks like it's not, and here's where the areas of tension are. And where there is areas of tension, which I think there clearly are in this legislation, that should be squarely before Parliament to consider whether, on the balancing exercise under Section 5, whether the limitation is demonstrably justifiable in a free and democratic society. And I think it ultimately is. So my worry is not so much the overall conclusion, but that Parliament ought to have the question squarely before it, so it openly and very transparently discusses any limitations on the rights that I think are clearly limited.
Okay, but unusual times require haste is the riposte. So are you happy that haste is needed?
Oh, I am. I mean, the counter argument is that the government should have had the legislation, had a plan long before this, so we could have debated it, a while back. But ultimately, you know, I just looked up some figures this morning out of curiosity about conscription of soldiers in World War One and World War Two, 1916 and 1940. In 1940 in New Zealand, 312 young men were conscripted against their will in order to be able to fight a very serious challenge of Nazi Germany and Japanese and Italy. We have a threat, and I'm one who thinks the threat is real, and that millions of people have died around the world as a consequence of this, and countries that are our size have had thousands, if not tens of thousands of people die. In the context of that risk, I think that the limitations on our freedom, which are clearly there, are reasonable and justifiable.
Yeah, I was thinking about conscription in this context because I was doing some research for our chats later about war. Ali, do you by and large agree with what Chris, I heard you signal assent somewhere during that. Do you agree with what Chris was saying?
I've got to stop doing that. It's terrible, isn't it? Give someone else a go and just shut up and just let them speak. I think what worries me a little bit is when I hear people in the media, and these are well-respected, intelligent, experienced people who are knowledgeable about matters of privacy and human rights. And there was a woman, and I can't remember her name, I'm sorry, I've seen her in the last couple of days, and she raised a really relevant issue about one of the points in this change in the law. And what I was going to say is I take Chris's point about the need for haste, and you know, you raise the flag about some of the issues that might be needing to be looked at more. But I'm not hearing that being done. It sounds as though it's being pushed through pretty much as is with some tweaks. And when you've got some people who are able to raise issues and concerns, why is that not being done from what we can see inside Parliament as well? So, yeah, I mean, but I do agree with Chris pretty much with what he said there.
13 minutes to 9 o'clock. Ali Jones, Chris Gallivan on the panel. Just quickly, speaking of human rights and health bureaucrats blocking Māori vaccine efforts, is it common sense, as John Tamahere says, being able to individually approach the unvaccinated, or is it overreach for privacy reasons? Just quickly, both of you, Chris.
Oh, I thought you'd go to Ali first, actually, because this is a really knotty one, of course. There's a couple of issues. One is about approaching the individuals, and then the second issue is about, well, who approaches the individuals? And, of course, that might be organisations that say that they represent either ethnically or culturally or religiously or whatever the category might be, that they represent those individuals. And that's always a very difficult claim to make. it might be common sense, but I'm going to say something controversial here. Often law and regulation isn't based on necessarily common sense. It's based on what's workable and what's able to be administratively executed in a way that is relatively efficient. If there were 100 people in the country, then we could probably have common sense apply almost all the time, but we don't. And we have billions of people in the world, so we have to have some form of applicable regulation that's able to be done in a way that's relatively uniform. So I think, you know, that on balance, that we ought not to be able to approach individuals in the way that's been suggested, merely because I think the dangers of abuse of that and the difficulties that give rise will create such a hornet's nest that it will outweigh the benefit and the good.
Okay, Ali, where are you on this?
Yeah, I don't agree with Chris on that. I think going back to the greater good argument, the issue that this has killed millions of people around the world, the fact that we know that the groups that are at greatest risk are these groups that John Tamahere and his trust have identified up north, basically negates that, Chris. I think that if there is a decent risk analysis done and that you can as much as possible remove some of those concerns, I do understand you don't want, you know, religious zealots, for example, or anyone of any kind of focused or blinkered view approaching people. I think if that is managed in an intelligent and common sense kind of a way, it is the best thing that we can do. I think the privacy laws are widely work well in this country, but are often wrongly used to prevent positive and good things being done, common sense things being done. I think privacy laws are in place to protect the individual. Well, I don't think this will protect the individual in the greater scheme of things as far as COVID's concerned.
I can't tell you what the audience is thinking because my texts have disappeared temporarily, unfortunately. COVID cases may have peaked, said COVID modeller Sean Hendy on Monday.
And we're seeing a bit more of a stabilisation. It doesn't mean that the outbreak's going to go away, but it does mean that maybe we've seen the peak of the outbreak.
Up until that point, a reported rolling average of 186 cases a day. Since that point, over 5 days, 183, so not bad forecasting. But it was previously said to have peaked on August the 28th, and a dump of papers showed just before the government moved Auckland out of level four modelling projected an eventual return to elimination. Do you think the numbers have peaked now? Do you think they will climb like last time? Again, just quickly, both of you, Ali?
Yeah, look, I think we are going to get some more, and I think it's just a matter of when those borders open. Well, you're going to take what has so far been kept constrained pretty much in Auckland and in the North Island. I mean, it's going to spread, isn't it? That's exactly what's going to happen. And so, yes, I do see the numbers going up again. But I'm not an expert in this. You've got to listen to the modellers.
Yeah. Chris?
Oh, ditto. Couldn't have said it better myself, Ali. I have no idea. My gut tells me it's going to increase. My logic tells me, but guided by nothing other than my life experience of like, well, surely it's going to mean that there's going to be more if people are going to be able to move out of Auckland where the majority of infections are. It just seems logical that it would be there would be more, but I'm not a modeller. So I hope the modeller's right. I hope we...
You're still allowed a modelling opinion, though. The traffic lights start flashing this week with 340,000 New Zealanders not towing the line.
When I say red light, I need you to stop. When I say green light, I need you to go.
Are you clear red light. About them? I mean, do you see the traffic lights as a superior way of managing the pandemic? Are you worried about the social schisming that will result, Ellie?
Yeah, I am. I saw this in Christchurch with the earthquakes. When you're under stress and you're under pressure, when you change things, I think people struggle to follow them normally, and certainly under pressure will as well. I don't know why it was changed. I don't know what I'm missing here. And red light, that still doesn't make sense because it sounds like an improvement, but we're going to red. I would have preferred to stay with the level system, but that's just me.
Chris? Oh, we may not have Chris, because I did hear a Skype sound a few moments ago. Maybe that was the sound of Chris disappearing and our trying to get back hold of him. So, Ali, it's just you and me at the moment until we get Chris again. Signs of social disintegration. The human cost of living next to neighbours from hell is a headline in the Herald this morning, I notice. An emergency housing motel manager is beaten, she says, after asking a tenant to clean her room, and nothing in the end is done about it. A Kāinga Ora house in Whangarei with supposed Black Power association of some sort terrorising an elderly couple next door. Nothing much seemed to be able to be done about it. The Auckland CBD claimed to be slipping into anarchy after dark. The police say it's a tricky situation needing a multi-agency response. Do these sorts of instances worry you? I suppose that's a rhetorical question, but do you think anything really can be done about them? Yes, can you? I assume you guys are hearing, Ali.
I can hear you, Jim, but can't hear.
Sorry, I thought Ali was. This is just to explain things for the listeners. I heard Ali very faintly in the background without knowing what she was saying, so I assumed that everyone else was listening to Ali, and that it was just my fault that I couldn't hear her. But in fact, maybe nobody heard anything. So if that was the case, then it's you and me, Chris. Did you hear the question I was asking, Ellie?
No, I just hear the end of it, Jim. I'm sorry about that. I got put on hold when I think Ellie might have got another call on Skype. But
okay, and my apologies to everyone for the technical.
We roll with the punches on.
We roll with the punches when we're broadcasting from a few locations. In my case, a little study in the house. All right, I was talking, Chris, about the signs of social disintegration and dislocation that we are seeing in New Zealand at the moment. The violence on the streets, I suppose, is one thing. Claims about the unruliness of the Auckland CBD, the elderly couple in the house in Whangarei living next to neighbours that not a whole lot can be done about, and the question of what you can do about people in social housing. So, Chris, what do you think any options are for us in these areas?
Well, of course, if I was to channel the ACT Party, I presume that they would say it's just more police bobbies on the beat and take them away from doing things that are not very effective, i.e. policing borders with COVID. But that is one part of it, absolutely. I've got no issue with that. The other part, of course, is that New Zealand and the world has a crisis of anxiety, anxiousness and mental health. People are very, very stressed. Just a quick Google search this morning. The same is happening with political violence, in particular in the United States. The same is happening in England. It's happening across Europe. People are stressed. They are at their wit's end as far as COVID is concerned. Of course, climate change. We just had COP26. There's a lot going on in people's lives, so much so that I agree. I think that there is an element of social cohesion unravelling, and I think it is I hate to say this, it's a multi-agency, it's a whole-of-society issue. It's not really fixed by just having more police on the beat, although that would be helpful at the same time. So, you know, a housing issue, I mean, is it any surprise that people in emergency housing, which I think there's about between 8,000 and 9,000 at any one time currently in New Zealand, are in motels, and that gives rise to violence and awful behaviour. That's probably of no surprise to us. So we've got to deal with housing, we've got to deal with mental health, we've got to deal with people's health and well-being as part of the public health issues that we face, but also get people back to work and back to some semblance of normality with life.
Indeed. Ali, I think we've got you back now, so I better get your opinion on this thing as you began to express it.
Well, I was just going to say no one should have to put up with this kind of disruption and abuse, right, that we've heard in the stories, but I hate that heading in the Herald this morning. I mean, all it does is stigmatise community housing people, and later in the story it does acknowledge good tenants in Kāinga Ora, but it does note too that they have 200,000 tenants, half of whom are children, but 200,000 tenants, and there are three stories in that Herald story this morning. So let's keep it in context. And another thing is that this goes on around the country in suburbs and neighbourhoods around the country. Again, I'm not saying it's right, but, you know, I had a family member who had to move out because she was being intimidated by a neighbour to the point that they had a heavy object thrown through the window that just missed their young son's bed at that stage. So, you know, this kind of reporting stigmatises community housing and social housing tenants when there are some really good, hardworking tenants
there, people, just like any neighbour, but neighbourhood. But I do agree with Chris, this is multi agency, and it is wider, it's a wider societal issue. And I see that Podal Williams says that we've made a conscious choice to actively manage difficult tenants, providing wraparound support from a range of government agencies and other community health providers. Well, to that I go, pfft. And that noise means I've had enough of that kind of explanation. We've still got people waiting for mental health. Months and months they're on waiting lists. We don't have enough cops, Chris, and I know that that's often said, but it's true. And we need to start getting these services up to speed, and God knows we've had long enough to do it, so that we can deal with this. At the moment, it's just an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff.
Thank you both. I don't have time to talk about Adele, unfortunately, and apologies for all the technical hassles we've had, which our listeners are noting this morning. Just quickly, I've said that three times in the chat with both of you, pressure on Rhythm and Vines not to go ahead in Gisborne. The Bay of Plenty, Iwi Te Whanau Aapanui, wants visitors to stay away this summer. Fair enough, or should that be mandated by a government concerned about health consequences? Because this sounds like it could be a knotty situation, Chris, too, as we head into the warmer months.
Yeah, not mandated by the government. I think this is one for the community to decide, and I think all we should really do is respect the community. If that's their feeling and their concern, which is echoed around the country, then let's try and be respectful to people and conscious of the fact that when we're driving and when we're holidaying, people all around us have probably had a worse day than what we have.
Very good.